Thanks, Eileen. Thank you.
It's the Ray Dassey Show on RTE Radio 1. Enjoy the show.
Thanks, Dermot. There goes Dermot. And just to mention that he celebrated his first Holy Communion on Saturday, last Saturday. He goes to Carlstown National School in County Westmeath. And on Sunday, the family went to Kilmainham Jail for a tour. And he loves hearing himself on the radio. That's Dermot, our voiceover artist. We've had some guesting and we'll continue to do that, but Dermot is the main man in the opening. That's from his mum Fiona there. And I'm looking at a picture of Dermot in his first Holy Communion garb, looking very sharp, Dermot. Those tan shoes, love them, love them. Now, today, we're going to be talking to Abby Morgan. Now, about 4 years ago, Abby Morgan was probably sitting at home chatting to her friends about the fact she just appeared on Desert Island Discs and everything was going according to plan. She's an award-winning screenwriter. And then her world collapsed. Her world collapsed in the last 4 years of her life. Well, you wouldn't believe it if you didn't read it. I've read her memoir over the last few days. It is compelling. It's full of love. It's tragic. It's funny. It's brilliant. This is not a pity memoir by Abby Morgan. And we're going to be talking to Abby on the show today. Also, rugby legend, Johnny Sexton. We'll be chatting to him. I love Johnny Sexton. I love him. He's brilliant at what he does. And he is himself, always. He is always Johnny Sexton. And after 4 o'clock, we have our relationship experts, Alison Keating, who's a psychologist, and psychoanalyst Ray O'Neill. And if you want advice from them, FOC, free of charge and in confidence, you can get your relationship problems into us now, ray@rte.ie, and Alison and Ray always give good advice. They don't always agree with each other, but it's always considered and well worth hearing. So ray@rte.ie if you want advice on any relationship woes. Now, just updates on people you may have heard on the show, and there's a number of updates here. Margaret Leahy, you remember Margaret? Margaret was the lady with the clocks. So she has her children all over the world, and she has 4 or 5 clocks on the wall, and each clock is set to the time zone that her children are in, whether it's America or Australia or wherever. And we've spoken to Margaret a few times, and she's set up Irish arts and food tours. And I remember saying to her, and I'm not taking credit for this, but I remember saying to her, God, Nationwide will be on to you about that. And they were. And tonight, Margaret Leahy features on Nationwide. You might remember Margaret. She was widowed at the age of 49. And her husband died suddenly, and they were big travellers and all that sort of thing. And it's taken Margaret a while to get back into it, but she's back travelling now, and she's doing this Irish arts and food tours, which you will find out more about on Nationwide tonight at 7 o'clock. So that's great. And it's great to see that Margaret's getting a sort of an advert for her business on Nationwide. That's what it is. Now, still on travel and people you would have heard on the show, James McManus, we've spoken to him twice now. He's a Tipperary man and he's hoping to climb to the top of Mount Everest without the use of supplementary or bottled oxygen. I said at one stage that he was going to climb Mount Everest without oxygen, which would be physically impossible because we all need oxygen for our bodies to work. But without supplementary oxygen, in other words, he won't have bottled oxygen on his back. And if he is successful, it will make him the first Irish person to do that. And he will be in a very small club of just over 60 people who have managed to conquer Everest without supplementary oxygen. Well, we've got another update from James. May 24th. Now we're on May 18th. So 6 days' time looks to be the date when James will make history. That's if he's successful, weather permitting. So that's when he's going for the summit. So there's all sorts of climatization, and you go up and you come back down, go up and come back down, go up a bit further, come back down, so that the body gets used to the height you're at. And they call them rotations. And he's talking about this, and he sent us this. My third rotation was extremely tough. I went higher than ever before and pushed my body to the limit. I feel confident now I'll be able to make history on May 24, 2022 and become the first Irish person to climb Everest without the use of supplementary oxygen. You can get more updates by following Earth's Edge Instagram page. Earth's Edge Instagram page. And he has to do all sorts of things like slowing down his body because, you know, the faster you go, the more oxygen you use, the higher your heart rate is, the more oxygen you use. So it's a big challenge. It's a big challenge. So we'll be watching that and keeping you informed. We spoke to Ferdia Walsh-Pilo. Ferdia starred in Coda, which won the Best Film Oscar this year. He also starred in... What was the name of it? Sing Street. Well, news just in, and good news for Ferdia Walsh-Pilo. He's to star in Frankenstein, the movie. It's a film. Well, it's a Frankenstein movie. It's not called that. It's called Mary's Monster, and it's about Mary Shelley, author of the Frankenstein novel. And Ferdia Walsh-Pilo is to play Percy Bysshe Shelley, husband to the author. So that's good news for him, and well done. David Gray is finally getting to do his 20th anniversary concerts. They've been put off and put off and put off again. But this weekend, he is in town. And it's the 20th anniversary of the release of White Ladder. Bit of a cheat, because it was actually released in 1998. But anyway, this tour, which has been planned for a long time, is coming to fruition now. And David is coming into us. We're all very excited. He's coming into us on Friday for a chat. We'll be playing clips of his songs. And what we want to do is sort of try and capture what White Ladder meant to Ireland. Because over 300,000 of us bought White Ladder back in the day. And I'm sure it was the soundtrack to relationships, breakups. It was used for first dances at weddings, This Year's Love, and all sorts of things. I'm sure there are hundreds of stories, thousands of stories out there that feature David Gray's White Ladder in them. And we'd love to hear them. And then on Friday, when he's in, we can maybe just share them with David, or maybe you might want to talk to him, to tell him your story. It'd be great if you got them into us, ray@rte.ie. Everybody has a David Gray story, or was that Bono? ray@rte.ie. So I think that's all the business done. 51551 ray@rte.ie. I'll tell you about our quiz in a moment. But first, a bit of this. Colin Nicini coming up easy, and he's coming to Ireland in August 21st, the Milk Market in Limerick, and on the 24th of August, he's in the Olympia Theatre in Dublin. That's our anniversary, our wedding anniversary, 24th of August. I might treat Jennifer Kelly to a night out in the Olympia Theatre, or maybe not. We'll see. Could you wish my sister Marie Taylor from Forehouse, Dublin, a very happy 60th birthday today from all her sisters, Sinead, Adrian and Helen, and all her nieces and nephews and wider family and friends. Done. Happy birthday, Marie Taylor. And would you mind playing a request for Betty Conlon? She listens every day. She likes George Ezra, Budapest. We'll see what happens with that. I won't tell you her age, but she is the best in the world and a lovely mother-in-law and friend. Love Deirdre, Samuel and Raymond. Happy birthday, Betty. And Stephen has been on. I'll never forget White Ladder, as it was my wonderful wife Adele, all she played for the first 3 years of our relationship. She was mad about his music. That's Stephen in Last Nevin. I'd say she wasn't on her own, Stephen. 300,000, that's mad sales for a country our size. Do the maths on that percentage of the population that had a White Ladder CD in their house. And you'll be surprised. Now, here. Reeling in the ears, looking for two people to come on after 4 o'clock and answer three questions on little clips they will hear in their ears. Bits of songs, news reports, TV shows and movies. And there is a prize. And today, it's a two-night stay with dinner on one evening in the Radisson Blue Hotel and Spa in Cork. It's a warm and inviting destination on the doorstep of Cork City. The Radisson Blue, beautiful blend of 18th century Ditchley House, a charming manor house perfectly restored, and two contemporary wings with modern facilities. So one lucky listener will get an overnight stay for two adults with breakfast on both mornings. Alright, and then a dinner on one of the evenings. Make the most of your location and get into Cork City. Visit the English Market and savour the flavours of all the foods on offer, or get in some retail therapy on Patrick Street, or go off west or east. There's loads of things to explore in County Cork. RadissonBlue.com/Hotel Cork. And you will have to answer our qualifying question, which is this. Johnny Sexton had one of the best games of his career at the weekend. We'll be talking to him shortly. What sport does he play? What sport does Johnny Sexton play? 0818 715 925. 0818 715 925. And good luck with that.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, Ireland and Leinster captain Johnny Sexton is an ambassador with Leia Super Troopers. He's celebrating their health homework programme. It's aimed at children aged 9 to 12. And the Leia Super Trooper TV series is available on demand. You can find out more at leiasupertroopers.ie. And Johnny joins us now from Skerry's Educate Together National School out in North Dublin. How are you doing, Johnny?
Very good, thanks.
Yeah, good to talk to you. Congratulations on the win against Toulouse. How are you feeling a few days after?
Yeah, good. Obviously delighted with the result. Obviously a good few sore bodies after it. They're a very tough team and big men. So last few days spent recovering and now turning the page and preparing for Munster this week and then La Rochelle next week.
Yeah. Do you get a chance at all to sort of warm yourself in the glow of a brilliant performance? You were on fire on Saturday.
Yeah, look, you sit down, you review the game and we all were happy enough with our performances, but we know that La Rochelle is going to be a much tougher test. You know, yeah. I think with all the greatest respect to Toulouse, I think that they played 100 minutes the week before against Munster, and we knew that if we kept the pace of the game high, they might struggle based on how tired they were and all the travel they had to do. So it'll be very different. La Rochelle will be, I suppose, much fresher and better prepared for the final.
I know you from speaking to you over the years, and you're not going to blow your own trumpet, quite the opposite, but that sidestep you did which set up the try, it was about 19 minutes or so for Josh Van der Fleer, it actually looked like you're in a computer game, Johnny. It was all perfect. It was brilliant. Did you look back at that at all?
Yeah, of course. It's part of the review.
And what happens is are you doing it in company? Would there be a big cheer from all the lads when you did that?
No. We do. No. It's all business, really. I think we look at the good moments, of course. Stuart's very good at that when he's doing the review, looking at the good things we've done. Because sometimes you can go into games or review of games and you just concentrate on the bad. But he always looks at the good but also explains why the good happens. And a lot of what happened in that moment was down to the players around me doing exactly what they should be doing and executing really well. So it was very much a team thing. Yeah, it was a good moment, an important moment in the game.
Yeah. I see the French press referred to you as rust-free Johnny Sexton. How do you feel about a comment like that?
I don't listen to the French press too much.
I suppose they're looking at you, your age, and they're thinking, how is this man doing this? How is he so fresh, so energetic, so driven?
Just the hard work, really, looking after myself. That's all it takes. It's not like there's lots of other players playing a lot older. I saw Jimmy Goppert playing another semi-final at 39. So and he was playing really well as well. There's other players across the world that are playing at the same age. So it's not groundbreaking. I think it's just, like I said, making sure you're dedicated to your craft and working hard and doing everything possible to stay fit and healthy.
You are, yeah. So La Rochelle at the end of the month, 28th of May, down in Marseille, they beat you, as in La Rochelle beat Leinster, in the semi-final last year, 32-23. So that'll be on your mind, I presume.
Yeah, of course. We've already sort of sat down and had a look at some of the parts of that game and to try and learn the lessons, because they're an outstanding team. I think obviously in the semi-final it was a real arm wrestle against Racine, and that's not what we're used to seeing from them. You know, they're normally a very expansive team with lots of offloading and obviously really well coached by two Irishmen, Dunnock Ryan and Rog. So we're expecting a incredibly tough game, and what happened last year obviously is something that we need to learn from.
And already they're making something of the fact that Rog is the man in charge down there, and a lot was made back in the day when he was the old guard and you were the new boy in town looking for the number 10 position in the Irish shirt. Was that a real clash, or was that just made up by the press?
A bit of both. Same now. I don't know how it's getting dragged into this. I thought it would be O'Gara against Contepomi. I don't know, because Roger's now a coach, so it shouldn't be anything to do with me against him. So look, he's done a fantastic job with La Rochelle to to get to three consecutive finals is an incredible achievement in itself, you know, with the team that, I suppose, in the competition that they play in the top 14, to be able to juggle both is a,
yeah, a great achievement. A
crazy achievement, yeah.
It's 13 years on now from that game. It was a semi-final in Croke Park, huge crowd, Leinster v Munster. Gordon Darcy goes over in the corner for a try. And you and Rog are there at close quarters, and there's that picture still there of you saying something to him. Can you? It's 13 years on. Have you ever shared with anybody what you said to him?
But no words were exchanged.
Go on. No, so you just opened your mouth. You just roared.
I think. Look. I think people are sick of hearing the story now at this stage. Like you said, it's 13 years ago, so it's probably time
to move on. I suppose the fact that he's in charge down in La Rochelle and you're playing a European final next week, that's why people are resurrecting it, and you can understand why they would. Your contract was extended there a few weeks ago, and you're going to be with Ireland and Leinster till after the World Cup, which is in 2023, September 2023. At which stage you'll be 38, Johnny, and you feel that you have enough to bring you to France to play in the World Cup?
Yeah, that's why I signed on. I wouldn't have signed on if I didn't feel I could get there. And you know, it's not about just getting there. It's about getting there in the best shape possible, and I'm still being able to perform and at the highest level. So that's my motivation, and that's why I signed on. I'm delighted to do it. I feel I'm part of two very special environments, and I wanted to keep it going for as long as I possibly can.
Great. Now, Ireland are touring New Zealand in the summer. And we've never beat New Zealand on their turf in New Zealand. That's a big ambition, obviously, for the team.
Well, it's the biggest challenge in world rugby, winning a test in New Zealand, and not very many teams have done it. Certainly Ireland, no Irish team has ever done it. So we came close maybe once or twice, and it's going to be a big motivation for us, of course, but it's a long time away at the moment.
Lots of things to do before. Yeah.
Let us get the next couple of weeks out of the way before we start talking about that.
Fair enough. Listen, the last time we spoke, Johnny, you were auctioning off a pair of your boots, the boots you wore for your 100th cap in that 65 victory over Japan, a pair of 9.5 Adidas Predators, and you were auctioning them off for Deborah Ireland, which is a great cause, and you're an ambassador and have been for years. And they raised €24,000.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
Absolutely delighted for them that they managed to do that amount. Obviously, we did it slightly differently. We did everyone bought a ticket through a raffle, and then we just picked out a name out of a hat, really. And I actually gave the boots over the other day, would you believe? So, the lady Nuala was absolutely delighted that she won them. And she lived in Germany, so she had to travel home to get them. Right. And she's going back with them now. So hopefully they take pride of place in her house somewhere.
Yeah, did you ask her what she's going to do with them at all?
I didn't.
No.
wear them around the house, yes, maybe yeah, wear them around.
Not advisable on tiles, I would imagine. Yeah.
No, but they're a very special boot to me. Like, they've got little Adidas did a great job with sort of making them very personal in terms of the initials of my kids and wife, and you know, the 100 caps on them and a little Irish flag and all those little touches that I suppose will make them very special.
Speaking of your family, Laura, Luke, Amy and Sophie, I was reading somewhere that when you were going up for a kick, and you'd done so many pressure kicks for Leinster and Ireland, and I suppose Racing back in the day as well, over the years, that sometimes in the middle of the preparation that you might think, is Warren Gatland watching me, or has Laura got her head in her hands, or what's going on there? And then you have to flick yourself out of it. That happens on a regular basis, does it?
Well, not on a regular basis, but from time to time, it's you know, it's amazing what can come into your head. I suppose for me, the biggest challenge has always been trying to block out that. It's not noise; it's just those thoughts, and get it into your process. And often it is a little thought like that snaps me into getting into my process and routine, and making sure I nail that. And you know, if the ball misses or goes over, and once I've nailed my routine, then I'm done all I can do. That's the key for me.
About routine, you'll be a much sought after man when you retire, Johnny Sexton, because people will want to know, and I don't know if you'll share with them, what made you so good? What drove you? You know, how you were able to concentrate on those big moments, that drop kick. I'm thinking about that drop kick after how many phases of play against France in a few years ago. And will you be doing that? Do you think that's the sort of thing you'd like to do?
Potentially, like I hope to add value somewhere. I'm doing a bit of work experience at the moment with a great company and doing one day a week, trying to prepare myself for life after rugby with a company called the Ardagh Group, and they're fantastic. I've been up there learning from their people, and very impressive. And so hopefully, you know, when rugby finishes, it might go in there and they might be able to learn a few things from me. And I hopefully I've done a commerce degree, will be able to learn a lot from them and throw myself at a different part of life away from sport. And then I think I could add something to sport as well. But I think with family life, it's very difficult to become a coach because you need to do the hard yards. You see, you know, we talked about Rog, obviously.
Yes.
What he did, retire, go to New Zealand for a while, go to France for a while, then back to France again, and I'm not sure I'm willing to do that,
right, okay,
to be a coach. But rugby is all I've known really for the last whatever 20 years plus. So it'll be a big loss whenever I let it go.
Yeah, but I suppose it's something that you have time to think about and prepare yourself. And it's obvious from what you say that you are preparing yourself. What business are they involved? The people you do one day a week with?
Glass and metal packaging.
Right.
But it's on the business side. I won't be in the factories making the glass, but you know, dealing with people and customers, and it's really insightful at the moment. And like I said, learning a lot. And it's such it's so transferable, sport and business. I think there's so much in common in terms of high standards and efficiency and
teams,
I suppose.
Teams
driving each other, making sure you're doing the best job you possibly can, and doing it within the team for their values and all that. So it's very transferable.
Now your children are just outside the target market for this Leia Super Troopers. It's health homework program, and you can go to leiasupertroopers.ie for more information. I know you're sort of second generation rugby. Your dad played rugby, didn't he? So, is there a gene? Is there a talent? Is Luca showing any signs of being an international rugby player?
He's involved anyway. That's the first step. It's very important, I think, for kids to participate in as many sports as they can. You know, it doesn't have to be one or the other. It can be multiple, and I think they all prepare you. But I think just for kids to get out and about, exercise, I think it makes, I can see it, how much of a difference it makes to their mood, to their well-being, you know, after exercise, compared to if they're locked up in the house all day watching TVs or screen time and all that. So I see it firsthand as a parent, and encouraging them to, and that's what this campaign is all about, really. It's about encouraging them, making it part of their homework, really, to get out and about and do various activities, whether it's nutrition or health and well-being or a bit of yoga, breathing, it ticks all the boxes.
All
that's
the good
fantastic
stuff.
It's fantastic to get behind.
Yeah, and well worth being involved in. LeiaSuperTroopers.ie. Johnny, good luck in the final and everything else. And great talking to you again. Thanks so much for taking time out to talk to us. Thanks, Johnny.
Thank you. Thanks, Ray.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, this time around 4 years ago, our next guest, Abby Morgan, was doing Desert Island Discs and talking to Kirsty Young about her career as a screenwriter, talking about working on The Iron Lady, the biopic of Margaret Thatcher, winning Emmys and BAFTAs. Little did she know that a couple of months later that her life was about to take a huge dramatic twist that would be worthy of any of her screenplays. And she writes about the twist and the 4 years after, or 3 years after, in her new memoir, This Is Not a Pity Memoir. And Abby Morgan joins us on the line from London. Good afternoon, Abby.
Hi, Roy. Ray. Thanks for having me on the show. Yeah. Sorry, just the sound went. Hi. Yeah.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Congratulations on the book, and I know it's your life, and it's not a work of fiction, but it reads like a work of fiction sometimes, and that wasn't lost on you. was it?
No, I mean, I think, you know, I'm a screenwriter by trade. So actually very quickly I was seeing everything in forms of scenes, and consultants were talking in dialogue, and, you know, moments of kind of medical crisis were plot twists. So I think it was the way I kind of preserved my sanity, actually. It was just to go back to all the skills that I'd honed over the last 20 years.
And for that reason, there's loads of humour in it, because you have this internal editor, which along the way is editing large pieces of your life out of a book or a movie that might come in the future.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's always, I always had that voice. I mean, you know, what happened to me was so left of field, and what happened to us as a family. I think I just drew on everything I knew and started to think, well, actually, how do I keep track of this? How do I hold on to this? You know, it was so extraordinary and it was so unexpected that I think, you draw on the talents that you have just to survive it.
To remain sane. So it was May 2018, you were on Desert Island Discs.
Yes.
And then in June of that year, your partner, your longtime partner, father of your two children, Jesse and Mabel, he collapsed. Now, he suffers with MS. And at the beginning, you just thought it was another episode.
Yeah, I thought it was a bit of man flu, actually.
Right.
You know, I think I threw a packet of paracetamol at him and ran downstairs. But you know, you're right. It was. I'd just done Desert Island Discs, and it took me a long time to listen to that again, actually, because obviously I spoke quite a lot about my family, in particular about Jacob and my relationship. But June 2018, I'd gone out for the morning. He had a headache, and when I came back, having done my school run and pick up of coffee and just generally self absorbed with myself, I came home and found Jacob collapsed on the bathroom floor, and so ensued the kind of start of what's been nearly 3.5 years now of life-changing kind of medical catastrophe.
And I've listened back to your Desert Island Discs, and it's not smugness, but you were definitely happy with your lot.
Absolutely.
At that stage.
I think it's absolutely. I'm really pleased you've listened to that, Ray, because I think it really puts context to the book. But yeah, in many ways, I think I felt very lucky. I mean, I think Jake and I used to kind of feel this sense of wow, we're okay, we're on dry land, and I definitely think that comes through in the interview. And also, when you reflect on your life in that way, you always are going to pull out the good bits, aren't you? I think that's one of the things I learned was about the brand of family and how much I'd lent into the kind of brand of how it had to look. And, you know, with Jacob collapsing, you know, he collapsed, and very quickly it became apparent that, you know, cognitively, psychiatrically, physically, he was unraveling. And so within a couple of weeks, it was, you know, apparent that Jacob needed to be placed into a medically induced coma.
To me why they put people in an induced coma?
Well, I mean, Jacob, you know, it took a long time to work out what was wrong with Jacob, but he was basically repetitively seizuring, which means that, you know, your body, your whole electrical nervous system is under fire. And so as they tried to work out what was wrong with him, they realized that he had developed a rare form of encephalitis called anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis. And the reason why they decided to put Jacob in a medically induced coma is that his body was getting to a point that just the basic mnemonic function, you know, breathing, swallowing, you know, blinking, was just becoming really, really hard for him. And so the decision was taken to put him into this coma as a way that they could then medically work on trying to, you know, resolve his encephalitis and stop his seizuring.
So it sort of pauses bodily functions, does it?
Totally. It's like going into you're anaesthetized like you are in an operation state, but it's just an extended operation state. And boy, oh boy, was it extended with this one, because, you know, he went in the start of end of June 2018, and he woke end of January 2019.
7 months or thereabouts.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of time to think and reflect and, you know, sit by someone's hospital bed and you know, think about life and your relationship, I guess.
Yeah. And there's lovely moments in your memoir about how ye meet. It was a whirlwind romance, wasn't it?
It really was, actually. You know, I met Jacob in November and then pursued him via email that had just come in for a couple of months. And then we started seeing each other in January, and then I was pregnant by April. So we very quickly, you know, evolved into a relationship. And then we had our first son, Jesse. And then a couple of years later, Mabel came along.
Yeah, kindred spirits, it strikes me just from reading it. But again, you only include the good bits. No, that's not true, because you didn't. You include some of the bad bits as well.
Yeah, totally. I think I was, I tried to be as brutal. It's a brutal experience, but I think the person I was most brutal about was myself, really, because, it caused, I think Jacob, no one tells you about the activity around a coma. Ultimately, everybody's working, there are nurses doing medication, and there's a constant kind of team of therapists who are moving someone while they sleep. So while this was going on, I had a lot of time to sort of sit and observe and think about Jacob and actually think about myself and how I'd been as a partner and how I'd been as a mother and how I was as a person. And I guess that's what, and what the whole experience taught me really was this sort of self-reflection.
And what did you learn from that?
Well, I guess I've learned that I became as fascinated with myself as I was with a character in a movie. I started to sort of realize that actually this was, what was happening to us was a great drama. But I guess also, there was another plot twist when Jacob woke up.
Yes, well, I'm going to get to that. We've plenty of time.
Yeah. Don't,
you're moving it on now, because that's the screenwriter in you.
I guess it is. And I think you're right. I think you're totally right. I suppose I feel like I'm occupying quite a lot of space talking about the story at the moment. And I think in many ways, I'm genuinely surprised and relieved that people are responding so well to it, because I think I felt, certainly as the book came out, I felt that feeling, I've talked about this, but I felt that feeling a little bit like when you get drunk and the next morning you think, what have I said? Yeah. So I guess. The fact that,
Well, then when he came out of the coma and it wasn't movie-like, as in he didn't sit up and function normally. It was slow process, quite awkward. He grunted a few words. And then this happened. Was it Valentine's Day 2019?
Yeah, around about Valentine's Day, Jacob had been awake for about a month, and I'd started to notice that his reaction to me was slightly different to the way he reacted to everyone else. He was obviously pleased and delighted and very relaxed with everyone else, but there was a certain formality with me. And on Valentine's Day, I decided to kind of surprise him with a bright red, very cheesy cellophane balloon heart, and I tied it to his bed and kind of looked at him with expectation, thinking he'd think it was quite funny. And he was encouraged by the nurse to give me a red rose, which they had bought all the families on the ward, which was very sweet. But when she, when the nurse said, say hello to your wife, give the rose to your wife, he said, she's not my wife. And I think, one of two things. Technically, he was kind of right because we weren't married then. But also, I think you grasp at straws at that point. But, then very rapidly, I realized that Jake had developed this rare delusion called Capgras delusion, which you normally see in dementia patients, or after a traumatic brain injury, say a car crash, which is when you believe someone or something close to you is an imposter. And the focus of that delusion was on me, and that I was someone else. I wasn't, as Jacob put it, the real Abby Morgan.
You say in the book, it's not that he's forgotten me. He doesn't know me, can't locate me.
Exactly. I look different to the Abby Morgan he had in his head. The Abby Morgan in his head had long, long dark hair and blue eyes, and I had shoulder length brown hair at the time and brown eyes. So she was a very much a different person. And when you questioned and you said, where is this Abby Morgan then? He said, she's gone to live with someone else.
That's horrific, Abby.
Yeah, it is. I mean, when I hear myself say it now, I know I'm sort of, it still shocks me. And I think that's one of the experiences of talking about the book, is in many ways it's still quite live.
But the fact that, he described this other woman, long hair, yeah, blue eyes, taller than you are.
She sounded great. Yeah, she really did.
I mean, but was there jealousy on your part for this whatever figment of his imagination?
I think there was less jealousy for her. I mean, I was sort of, I was more just kind of, I think where I became very kind of passionate was my indignation about not being recognised. I think I'd felt like I'd spent the last sort of 6-7 months keeping our lives, our house, our children's lives together, and being there for our families, both our families, who were brilliantly supportive through this. And so for him to wake up and not know me, I mainly felt indignant and actually quite humiliated. It's humiliating when something like this happens to you. And I was kind of surprised. That comes back to the smugness again.
Yes.
I had my pride punctured. It was humiliating to be turned away and out of the room by a nurse or
And this is very rare, this CAPGRAS delusion.
Yeah, Capgras. It is. As I said, it is seen in dementia. I think I found a huge, I felt a huge connection with anyone who's experienced that. I found many stories of people whose, elderly relatives or, mothers, fathers, even husbands were going through dementia and that this was their response. But I hadn't found anybody, bar a couple of little bits of footage I found on the internet. But I couldn't find anything.
Here comes a bit of your internal editor, and so April June of that year, you're not feeling well. And it's one of those situations where you would say, and anybody would say, if they saw it in a movie, this doesn't happen in real life.
You're right. You're totally right. You're totally right. And I was really annoyed at the time when this thing happened. So basically, in about. Yeah, I mean, I think it's all about trying to control the narrative and trying to control something uncontrollable. And I developed a pain in my left breast, and I just put it down to driving every day, and it was my seatbelt rubbing, or maybe it was just the excessive amounts of caffeine and, Mars bars. I was stuffing in my face, but. A friend said, look, just go and get it checked out. And I did. And within 10 minutes of actually meeting the breast surgeon, and he told me that he was 99% sure I had breast cancer. And that was confirmed in a couple of weeks. So I was kind of reeling from this. But at the same time, I was thinking, that is such a bad plot twist. That's such a cliche. I've already had one cliche, which is, Jacob wakes up and he doesn't know me. And I've seen that in movies and it's not like it is in movies, I can tell you. And then this happened and I felt, cancer's massive. It felt like it was worthy of a film of its own. So for them to come together, I mainly felt initially, I think that was the shock again. I felt infuriated by it.
You have a black sense of humour.
Black. It's got darker and darker, I can tell you, through this.
Yes, and I suppose it was a survival mechanism as well, wasn't it, for you, that dark humour?
Absolutely, and I think anybody who's gone through it, experience, certainly, it's incredible. We know that the NHS is our heroes and they've been incredible the last couple of years, but when you're on a ward, it's so bleak some days that you have to laugh, and it's amazing actually how much humour and laughter there is, actually.
And times which seems unbelievable, you forgot, and you said it in the book, probably for dramatic effect, but that you forgot that you had cancer because you'd be discussing Jacob's future with doctors, as in bringing him home after rehab and all that sort of thing. And then they would have to remind you, but will you be capable of doing this because you have cancer?
I think that was denial and a survival mechanism. But also I became very practical with it. I felt like my children were one parent down and I was really shaken by the thought that they could be two. That just felt too much, So I guess I'd drawn everything, the friendship and the support of my family and friends.
Jacob's prognosis was pretty stark.
It was pretty bleak, I certainly through the coma period, we had several life and death moments. And then when he woke up, it became apparent there was a lot for him to relearn, and certain, what Jacob didn't have, and it became evident quite quickly, is he had no sense of agency or initiation. He didn't know who I was, but he didn't know how to communicate that. You had to really probe him, you had to really push him, and you also had to probe him and push him to do anything.
So was he acting like a child, or how would you describe how he was acting, this man that you brought home with you?
I think anybody who's been in ITU or has had a medical catastrophe, when you bring someone home, the rehab really, you think you've done the rehab at hospital, but it starts at home. So when we brought him home, I kind of hoped that the house would help him kind of realign and reconnect, and he was very silent. I mean, honestly, he was very quiet. He was very silent. He'd started to regain movement, which was great. But still, he had certain paralysis and he needed, at that time, 24-hour care. So I think I remember just before he arrived back, I had to video the house so that we could, show the hospitals how it would work and how he could move around the house. But also I showed it to him. And I remember him looking at the video of his house and me walking through it, all the scuffed paintwork and, familiar objects around the house. And he looked at it with kind of quiet fascination. that for a while I thought maybe he would reject the house, but actually when he came home, I think that started to really place him, and he very quickly sort of found his place at home. But I think as a family, we were, you know, I say about it in the book, you know, you're bringing home a stranger is not a stranger at all. You know, that's the strange thing, is that you know this person, and yet as much as I was a stranger to him, he was also in many ways a stranger to me and to my children.
Wow. And were you constantly or occasionally quizzing him about who you were and what you were to him?
Well, it's funny because, you know, the neuropsychiatrists work on this theory A, theory B.
Right, go on.
Idea, which, so theory A is, so, you know, you present it to Jacob, you know, theory A, Jacob, you're absolutely right, this is not Abby Morgan. But theory B, you know, we can never be 100% sure. So let's say 99% this is not Abby Morgan, but just say there's that 1%. And the idea is that you build every day that 1%, so it goes up to 5 and then 10 and then 15. And it never, ever worked. Jacob stuck resolutely at absolutely not. And so I just threw that out, really, and I did anything I could to provoke Jake. I would, you know, he'd put his porridge bowl down, I'd move it across the island for him. I would constantly ask him a question and then know about something that he liked, and then I'd know the answer to it to try and surprise him. And he would, so I did anything to really get his attention. Jolt him out of it, but also, you know, someone said early on, and I remember feeling I wanted to sort of smack them in the mouth when they said it, but they said, you know, well, I suppose the silver lining is, you know, you can fall in love again. And I remember at the time feeling really angry that, like, that's not going to happen. But actually it was a process of sort of trying to court Jacob again. You know, I took him out for tea, I took him out for lunch, I sat with him and watched his favourite programmes, I kind of tried to connect, I played a lot of Scrabble, you know, I did everything I could, and we as a family did everything
a second
could
courtship
to. In a way, yeah. And in a way, you know, whilst that was going on, I was also just reflecting on, you know, what kind of partner had I been and how had we got here?
And there must have been moments where you went, oh, no. And you say it in the book that you wish he had died on some occasions.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. That's the hardest thing for me to hear read back to myself.
Right, okay.
But I said it. And I think, you know, I said it because there were times where it was really hard. It was really tough. You know, it was very tough to, you know, one of the things that Jake developed was this idea that I worked for the state and that I'd been employed by the state to look after him and his children. And we sort of fell into that at the beginning, and then it evolved into friendship. And actually that friendship state was the one where I think I, you know, my empathy and my love for Jacob started to kick in, and it became less about him recognising me, but more about me helping him recognise himself, I guess, because that's what I realised more than anything, is that he couldn't remember me, but then it was really himself he couldn't remember anymore. You know, I was taking him out to see a consultant one day, and there was a kind of careful mechanics of leaning Jake up against the wall and, you know, managing to get his coat on him while you kind of turn around quickly to get your car keys. And as I turned around, I saw he caught his reflection in the hallway mirror, and I said, "Who is that?" And he said, "I don't know." And I said, "That's Jacob."
Wow.
And as soon as I realised he'd forgotten himself, it helped me reframe the experience.
There's so many sort of moments in the book that'll stop you in your tracks. And you, because of your cancer, your breast cancer, had to have a mastectomy.
Yeah.
And the morning you're going out to get your breast removed, you share this with Jacob. Well, you see, you're laughing. You see, that's.
I'm laughing because you're the first. You're the first one who's been bold enough to raise that one. And I'm quite impressed. I'm quite impressed with you, Ray. Really. Yes, I did. I mean, you know, what does a woman do when she's about to lose her breast, and the only other person who really knows your breast is your husband? I thought, well, maybe he'd like to have a look at it. Maybe just like to wave it off. And he looked at me with such horror.
Disdain. Yeah.
Just disdain. And then when I pushed, I said, why do you not want to see it? And he said, well, she wouldn't like it. And I knew who, and I said, who wouldn't like it? And he said, Abby Morgan. And I guess that was the moment where I thought, well, I'm kind of got to go out and do this on my own and think about how we move on when I get back, you know.
But it's an odd, I'd be the first one to slag off big tech companies, but it, like Apple saved the day. And those photographs that they throw up on your iPhone and your iPad.
So much so. Yeah, I mean, I think the digital age has been just absolutely vital. I mean, the digital age was how, actually it was my son who found out about CapGraph, for example, but also it was, you know, this huge digital library you have of your life together.
Yeah.
And so every day there was, you know, a memory would pop up on on the screen, and that was also, I suppose, part of on Jake's iPad when he would be reading his iPad in the morning. You know, there'd be another memory, and it would be a holiday or a Christmas or a, and one day a photo of him and I popped up, and I did this kind of. I remember, you know, I do wear it. I was unafraid to embarrass and humiliate myself in front of Jacob. And so I would sort of look at the photo and then look at my face and point to my face and look at the photo and hope he would go, oh, yeah, I get it. And he looked like he wasn't going to. And then just as I turned away, he said, yes, I'm starting to think there are similarities. And that was in the March 2020. So it took just over a year. Of sort of slowly rehab and being at home and slowly chipping away, and I guess just showing Jacob that helping that kind of, you know, the other thing is that, you know, a doctor said to me, you know, they've told me this Capgras not going to go after 3 months. If it's not gone after 3 months, it's going to stay. And I said, you know, I suppose it's like dementia patients. And the consultant said, well, no, but you know, dementia is all about decline and brain injury is about repair. And I think one of the things I take away from this is just how incredible the brain is and its ability to repair.
So to you first, you're cancer-free.
Cancer-free now, 2 years, just coming up to 2 years cancer-free, yeah.
Which is amazing. And just as a little, by the way, they're great because you're a screenwriter. There are, the book is littered with amazing movie references. My favorite is when you and him are going through similar, or maybe it's just you going through the cancer treatment. You referred yourself as one of the de-wigged witches from Roald Dahl's The Witches, which is a very good, because that's quite a scary image, isn't it?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So along the way, he was 5% of his former self, and there's going to have to be a new chapter, isn't there, at the end of the book?
Yeah, I mean, I try and leave the book on a hopeful note. And actually, you know, it's, you know, I end the book in March 2021. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what I can say is that Jacob in the last 6 months has made an astonishing recovery in a way that none of us could have expected or hoped for. And I feel, you know, that, yeah, absolutely. There's another year's worth of material, really. It's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing. And I think we're all still trying to recalibrate. But, you know, to give you an idea of it, you know, we just had a launch for the book and I didn't expect him to come. And he surprised me at the end and he got himself there and arrived. And it was the most amazing moment because, you know, there were people at the launch who hadn't seen him for nearly 4 years. So that was an amazing thing to see him back and see him, his wit and his humour and his joy for life starting to come back.
Brilliant. And that's a man who some of the doctors said would be incontinent for life.
Yeah, I mean, I think the expectation was that, you know, the damage that had been done was so severe that it would radically impair in his life. I mean, he's definitely still got a way to go, but I would say we're looking at 80% of the man now, okay, which is pretty impressive, I think.
So quickly, because we're running out of time, I could talk to you for another half hour at least. Will there be a movie, and will it be Olivia Colman playing you, and who will play Jacob?
Oh, this is what everybody's trying to trip me up on. I would love to make a movie. I mean, I've just started directing on this. Obviously, I write The Split, so I've just been directing on that. I'd love to make a movie on it, but let's try and sell the book, shall we?
Right, well,
and actually, a dream cast.
I think it sells
cast.
Itself. This is not a pity memoir. Go on, the dream cast.
Oh my gosh, I'm not even going to give names, just lots of amazing actors.
Well, you do
That's
mention Olivia
say.
Colman in the book, so
well, one
when
of
you're
many,
fantasizing,
I think.
Yeah, right. Abby Morgan, thank you very much. This is Not a Pity Memoir is in bookshops now, highly recommended from here. Thanks, Abby. Mind yourself.
Thanks, Ray. Bye, thanks for having me on.
Bye. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Tweet at Radio Ray RTE. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Anish Darcy now, the Preef Skelton and Oaktilla caught to Wallish. Gurmaga Coit, thank you very much. 5 on 5 5 on ray at rte.ie. Johnny is fantastic. This is for Johnny Sexton from the first hour. Johnny is fantastic. Without a doubt, he's in the best 10 in the world. Well, he got Player of the Year, didn't he, a couple of years ago? And a number of people wanted to say how big fans they are of Johnny Sexton. We recorded that this morning, so we couldn't put it to Johnny himself. But suffice it to say that Keane is a big fan and also Dermot's a big fan. And the next time we're talking to Johnny, we'll try and remember to mention your names to him. Now, it's time for Reeling in the Ears. Yeah, two quizzers standing by, looking to win a prize. And today, it's two-night stay with dinner on one evening in the Radisson Blu Hotel and Spa in Cork. The Radisson Blu in Cork, a warm and inviting destination on the doorstep of Cork City, which means you can explore everything Cork City has to offer, and indeed the county. The luxurious hotel is a beautiful blend of 18th century Ditchley House, which is a charming manor house, perfectly restored, and two contemporary wings with modern facilities. You can find out more at radissonblu.com/hotel-cork. Evan Murphy Keogh. Hello, Evan. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Ray. Can you hear me?
Evan. Are you there?
Yes.
Hi, Evan. How are you? Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can, yeah. Can you hear me?
Ah, Chris.
Yeah.
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Evan Murphy Keogh. Yeah, you're there. And you won't have far to go because you're in, if you win, you're in Cork City.
Yes, I am. I am. So I heard that it was for the Radisson and I said I might as well throw it in because we got married there. So,
oh, did you? All right.
Yes.
Right. How long ago did you get married?
6 years ago.
Right. Okay. You work in a technology company.
Yes, yeah, finishing up this Friday, so moving back to another company that I worked for previously, so going to food and beverage then, but going on holidays first for a week in Spain.
Right, that's all very exciting. Where are you going on your holidays?
Off to Mojaca.
Mojaca. Now, tell us about Mojaca.
You might not know it, yeah. A lot of people are like, where is that? It's in the southeast of Spain, so about 2 hours below Malaga.
Ah, right, okay, right. And it's on the coast, I presume.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So going with, we had the first grandchild of my parents came last year, so she's one. And so the whole family are going on a plane on Saturday and there's 8 of us. So it's going to be a whirlwind holiday for a week.
That's going to be a wild one. That's going to be a wild one, right. Okay. Now you're up against Yvonne. So Evan plays Yvonne. How are you doing, Yvonne?
Hello, Ray.
Whereabouts are you?
I am in Dublin, Sandymount.
Rightio. And you're a practice nurse in a GP practice.
That's right.
Right. That's a busy job.
It is busy, yeah. But it's very rewarding, as they say.
Yeah, yeah. And are you the first person? No, there's a receptionist and then they meet you. Is that it or what way does it work?
General route is reception and then the doctor and then they see me.
Aha, right.
So I do all the mop-up.
Right, yeah. Right. How long have you been working at that?
Oh, longer than I care to say. Well, I've been in practice probably 10 or 12 years.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great that we're out the other side. I'm just like, it's only this week now that some of the restrictions are gone in RTE.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like we were still wearing masks up until last week and we had restrictions on the number of people we could have in studio and all that's gone. So it's, there's a real sense of sort of returning to normality, isn't there?
Yeah, no harm in keeping the masks on for another while, though.
Right, okay, there's now Nurse Yvonne says no harm in keeping the masks on, right?
Yeah.
Who's at home with you?
Well, unfortunately, I'm home alone. I could do with a little bit of help, I'd say, but I'm home alone. Normally, my husband Peter would be here. Well, he'll be home this evening.
I know your husband Peter, do I?
Yeah, I think you do. Yes. The furniture, half of the best furniture shop in the world.
Yeah. We've a mirror in our hall, which we bought from your husband.
Right.
There you go.
So Flanagan Cairns, yeah.
Yeah, how are your children doing? Because there was doctors and everything there, was there?
There's one fellow's a doctor in Cork and one fellow's a GP in Dublin.
Right.
And then I have two girls who are both abroad, one in Berlin and one in London.
And what are they doing?
Well, one is working for a tech company in Berlin and the other one is doing a master's in health policy in the London School of Economics.
Right. Yeah. So empty nest.
And about 30 years ago, you gave the eldest fellow a prize for being the prettiest baby for Johnson & Johnson. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do actually.
And,
the prize giving was up in the old Montrose Hotel, which is now student accommodation for UCD. Would that be right?
That's right. And that fellow now has a gorgeous little son of his own called George.
No, you stop, Yvonne. I'm not going to talk to you anymore now. You're making me feel very old.
I know. But you were very young then. So
yes. So both of us were, of course, yeah. Okay, now, you know, Evan and Yvonne, how this works. Three clips each. If you go for a short clip, you get 2 points. If you go for a longer clip, it's easier, so you get 1 point. Whoever has the most points at the end gets the prize. And if it's a draw in points, we go to a tiebreak question. Good luck to you both. Here we go.
Good luck, Evan.
You too, Evan.
Right, Evan, to you then. The year is 1988. I don't know how that suits you. And we're on the telly. So do you want a short clip or a long clip?
We'll go for a long clip because I was only one at that stage.
Okay. A new coming-of-age comedy drama set in the 1960s, first debuted in 1988. Can you name it? And here is your long clip.
Do you want to go on the swings?
Yeah, sure.
And in the end, that's as far as Winnie and I went that day. Maybe we both felt we'd already come too far too fast. Maybe we both realized that growing up doesn't have to be so much a straight line.
And it is.
I think that maybe the Wonder Years...
Maybe you're right, and you get a point. Oh. Yes, and there was a remake of it on recently. I can't remember which streaming service it's on, but The Wonder Years 2022 was available for people to watch. Okay, well done on that. Now, Yvonne, 1988, television, long or short?
Short.
Okay. A new soap opera first hit the screens in 1988. Can you name it? Here's your short clip. Listen carefully.
Yeah, well, that's why we're here, mate.
Eh? Rue's pregnant.
I'm going to have Frank's baby.
Dramatic stuff.
Home and Away?
Yes.
Really?
It was one of two, wasn't it?
Well, Neighbours was actually before that because I was a student nurse in about 86 when it started.
You see, so you worked it out. Home and Away is the correct answer. You get 2 points. Wow. Put you in the lead. Right, Evan, back to you. Music from 1988. You were one. Let's see if you can remember. Well, what do you want to go, short or long?
We're going short, so we need to catch up with Yvonne now.
Yes, you do, yeah. This singer went to number one in the Irish charts with this song. Can you name the song or the singer? Here is your short clip. You gotta swing your hips now.
The Locomotion with Kylie Minogue.
It is, yeah. A lot of Australian references today. You get 2 points for that. Well done. Yeah, you're on three. Back to you, Yvonne. Music from 1988. Long or short?
I'm not very good at music. Long.
Long, okay. This was number one for 2 weeks in that year. Again, the song or the singer will do us for 1 point.
I do know, but I don't know.
Do you want to guess the name of the song would do me or guess another singer?
I'm just blank.
No. It's a groovy kind of love. Phil Collins.
Oh, I even saw him.
There you go, yes. Okay, well, it's close. Evan's on three, you're on two, Yvonne. So, Evan, your final question is on news and current affairs from 1988. Now, if you go for a long clip and get it right, you're on four. Yvonne can still catch you. If she goes for a short clip and gets it right. However, if you go for a short clip and get it right, it's more difficult, of course, but that would win you the competition today. So what's it going to be?
I'd have to go for a short clip, Ray.
Oh, you have? Okay, rightio. News and current affairs. A future international superstar who represented Switzerland won the Eurovision, which was staged in Ireland in 1988. Can you name her? And here is your... What, you can do it without even listening to it?
No, go on, you play it. Oh,
right, okay, right.
You know, to be the number one in the newspaper, it's not the important thing to me.
Who's that?
It is Celine Dion.
It is. You know your Eurovision. The song was Ne Partez Pas Sans Moi. And Ireland came in eighth place with the song Take Him Home, performed by Jump the Gun. That gave you 2 points, and Yvonne can't catch you. Sorry about that, Yvonne.
Oh, no. Okay, thanks, Ray.
You're up against the good one there.
Well done.
Listen,
well
great,
done.
Great,
well done, Yvonne.
Great talk. Do you say hello to Peter for me? And we'll send you out a couple of mugs, one for you and one for Peter.
Thanks a million,
okay,
Ray.
See you, Yvonne. Well bye,
done.
Bye, bye.
Bye.
Evan, congratulations.
Thanks, Ray. Delighted.
Yeah, and good luck with the new job that used to be your old job. And you're off to the Radisson Blu Hotel and Spa in Cork. You can find out more by walking down the road. No, you can find out more by going to radissonblu.com/hotel-cork. Okay, well done, Evan. See you now. Bye.
Thanks, bye,
bye, bye, bye, bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, our relationship experts are back. Alison Keating, psychologist. Good afternoon, Alison.
Hello.
And psychoanalyst Ray O'Neill. Good afternoon, Ray.
Good afternoon, Ray.
Great to see you. They're here to offer advice on any relationship woes you might have, and they come in regularly and they give good advice. So let's get straight to it. Dear Ray and Alison, hope you're well. I have an issue with my daughter-in-law. That's really troubling me. She calls to my house regularly with my son. I'm always welcoming and do my best to entertain, as I do with anyone that comes to visit. I always cook nice lunches, we have nice wine, but her mood always changes. She seems to have an issue with all my family, even though they have never done anything to cause that, but she seems to have a bigger issue with me. I've never said anything out of place. I agree with everything, whether I like it or not. And I don't discuss the upcoming wedding unless she brings it up. She sometimes speaks very disrespectfully to me. And on one occasion, when her mother visited with her, they talked about my daughter in a very disrespectful manner. My daughter is a beautiful girl and never gets involved in their business. I really think she is very odd. My son is a quiet man, and I feel it's almost like he's afraid of her. He spoils her and pays for everything, bills, rent, etc. This girl has never contributed to anything. If she showed some respect, I could ignore this, but she doesn't cook, clean or work and spends all her spare time with her mother, who is also very disrespectful. I've never said anything about this to her, and I'm wondering if I should. It really upsets me to see the way she is treating us all, especially my son, and my husband tells me I am too good to her. Any advice would be appreciated. Now, there's a tough one. Who wants to start with that one?
There you go.
Oh gosh, in-laws are outlaws, as we keep saying. Look, it is a very, very difficult situation here. I suppose what she needs to make a decision is, can she talk to her son and just on the quiet to say, look, I'm not trying to say anything, but here's my experience. Maybe this is just the nature of daughters-in-law and mothers-in-law, but I just need to share this with you because I'm presuming there's a wedding happening.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, before that red line is crossed, the conversation could happen, because once that red line has crossed, it just becomes a much more complex conversation. And our good friends and our good relationships always say the difficult things, and it will be difficult for your son to hear. But at least if this daughter-in-law is indeed controlling or incredibly selfish, and this isn't bias, those words of his mother's will stay with him. She's not trying to interfere, she's just sharing her opinion, and I think that's potentially the only conversation that can happen. Approaching this woman will just be nuclear.
Mm-hmm. So go approach the son.
Yeah.
Alison.
Totally agree. And like, just, you know, you get a lot from the way people write things, and you can tell that respect is very important to her. And at the most basic level, if someone comes into your house, you don't start slating their daughter. And also her mother doing that with, and then there's also a sense like that they've been talking about it outside, you know, and people feel really, really uncomfortable. They feel it's like someone kind of, it sounds like a strong word, but it's very threatening to come into your home and kind of berate your family. And I think this mother is worried for her son. But like Ray's saying, I totally agree. I would go back and approach this very honestly. But your intent, which I feel is in your words here, is to say, look, this is how I feel. What do you think? So it starts a conversation, and you're not putting him in a kind of a place where you're like, I can't believe she did this. It's not defensive. It's just opening it up.
Is any woman ever good enough for a mother's son?
Do you know what? Some people have great relationships with their
mother. Yes, no, I was joking.
It can be a very complicated relationship, but it doesn't necessarily need to be. Mm. And they're certainly starting off on the wrong foot. And that sense that she thinks that she's got a problem, not just with her, but with all of the family, it's them against us, which is a little worrying at the beginning of a relationship, because I think the fear I'm hearing here is that she'll pull the husband away because he's kind of quiet. And, you know, I think she genuinely is a little bit worried about him. So a conversation with him.
It's a really tough one, isn't it?
Mm. It is a tough situation. And the son here isn't helping the situation. Like that line that we say, all it takes for evil to thrive is for a few good people to do nothing. He's doing nothing.
Yeah.
So it's like, I get that he's got divided loyalties.
He could be madly in love. And as we all know, to use another cliche, love is blind.
Yeah. True.
Get his walking stick.
Right. Because it's a tough one. It is a tough one. I hope that works out. So the advice from both Alison and Ray is to have a conversation with your son.
Yes. Yeah.
And tread carefully. Dear Ray and Alison, in the last 6 months, my husband went from a red-blooded meat eater to a fully fledged vegan. It's causing awful issues in the house, because not only are we now in a situation where there are two separate meals being cooked every day, he is constantly pontificating about his new healthy lifestyle and gives out every time I cook a bit of chicken for myself. I'm happy for him to go do what he wants and have asked that he doesn't admonish me for eating meat, which I do twice a week. I'm trying to do my best, but we have two children and I'm afraid that he is going to influence them negatively about their diet. The worst part is dinner time, when he makes mooing sounds when I'm cooking. He says he's only joking, but I'm finding it quite upsetting as the kids have started to mimic him. Dinner has become a very stressful affair, and in the last couple of weeks I find myself leaving the house while he cooks and eating later. Is there any way of resolving this, do you think? Alison.
I think we have this kind of backwards approach sometimes. So the person feels like, well, I'm vegan, I'm doing, you know, they're feeling kind of self-righteous. And they're putting, and kind of they're really putting those feelings onto other people. I think everybody has a right to eat. And it's such a personal thing, but it's personal. Like in my house, I say to the kids when I put the food down in front of them and they go, "It's disgusting." Or like they point to the other child's food that is disgusting. Like we don't comment on other people's food. And I think that goes for everything. I understand that it's tricky to start making different meals. And I think they get used to that. But it is going to influence the kids. It already has. And I think a conversation where there's a respect on both sides. And I think that's where we get a bit kind of lopsided. It's like one person's right and one person's wrong. Everybody has a right to eat, and that's their choice. And you know, cooking is such an important part of life. You should feel comfortable in your own kitchen.
Yeah, the thing that really disturbed me was the mooing.
Oh God, yeah. I mean seriously.
And this is such an Irish thing, you know, like, "Asher, I'm only slagging." Well, it's just like, there's such a thin line, as every kid in the schoolyard knows, and we were all those kids in the schoolyard. There's such a thin line between slagging and bullying. Mm. And it is uncomfortable that when your humour is at somebody else's expense, I don't care if you're slagging them, you're bullying them. It's not, the joke is not funny anymore. So I would take that quite serious.
Yeah,
she does say, not to be picky, but she does say she eats chicken. So maybe he should be clucking and not mooing.
Do you know what's funny though? Like what I'm thinking about from the perspective of it, from a psychological point of view, you're putting disgust, that emotion, onto food.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, if you put disgust onto something, it's quite hard to actually eradicate it. So I think a very genuine conversation of, you know, that's my choice and you decided to change your lifestyle, that's no problem, but I'm going to ask you to stop commenting on mine.
Right.
I think that's such a powerful thing that Alison says, because there's two children here absorbing that disgust. And disgust around food is going to be a problematic area for any kids around their dietary, their relationship to their body and their food. Like, again, I suppose as midlife crises go, like, you might say veganism was a better option than the Ferrari, I was going to say, which is the affair with the Ferrari.
Vegan is a cheaper option, yeah, anyway.
And some might say the more ethical one. But again, it's just like, I think what would be really good potentially here is to meet him with support. "I'm so proud of you. You've really turned that around. I'm just not able to do that."
Yeah.
Use reverse psychology, which is an old trick of the book.
Yeah,
but it's
like
kind of just saying to
him,
"Well done. I wish I could." Yeah. I wonder, could you encourage
Maybe don't sound so condescending, as Ray did just then.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that's good advice, isn't it? Yeah. Well, yeah. It's again, it's a very difficult one. And the pontification and the mooing, worrying. I'm wondering there. You know, are there more problems there in that relationship other than just the food? It doesn't sound like a. What do you think?
It's hard to know. I mean, but I just think
I'm probably
that,
reading too much into
it. No, it's not that. But I just think we absolutely have to put boundaries in place. And I think with food, it is so psychological, and in terms of not just for them, but for the kids as well. I think we just have to be respectful.
Yeah. Okay. Right. I hope that works out. Dear Ray and Alison, during the pandemic, me and my girlfriend moved in together, and in and around the second lockdown. It meant so much to both of us because both our families lived in different counties and we relied on each other a lot. We really enjoyed each other's company, had lovely nights in with movies and takeaways and music and books. Now things are back to normal. She has started going out more and more. It started as two nights a week, then three. And there last week, she went out five nights in a row. She has loads of weekends away planned for this summer, and I'm not included in any of them. While I'm happy for her to see her friends, I think it's a little too much, especially after being so together for so long. I don't want to control what she's doing, but do your relationship experts think that there is any way of broaching it with her that I would like for her to be at home with me a bit more? Ray.
Look, I think after where we've all been for the last 2 years, I could definitely do it five nights in a row. I just don't know if my body would be able for it, but certainly I love the idea. Look, there's a certain kind of, the champagne cork is being released for a lot of people, and there's a lot of people with the long summer days making gorgeous plans, and rightly so. I think it's to find that balance, again, between encouraging her and going, "Look, this is great and fair dues and you deserve this," but saying, "I miss you." Rather than in any way trying to kind of go, "You should be doing this," or whatever, you know, meeting her in some way. And the best way to meet her is just saying, you know, "I miss you too."
Right.
I think it's just, I think this is something that a lot of people will relate to. And for some people, when lockdowns came around and in terms of moving in, and a lot of people moved in quickly because they weren't going to get to see each other. So possibly that was a quick move that mightn't have happened if the lockdown hadn't have occurred. So therefore, maybe she feels like there's still more going out that she actually wants to do. And people really have missed so much. There've been so many missed experiences. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I have to check what year it is. Yeah. Like quite often, like, is that 2020, 2021? And there's such a blur. And we're social animals. Like and the connection piece is so important. What I'm hearing is different temperaments here. Maybe this guy, he just loved the kind of, he's more introverted. He loved that one-to-one.
Takeaways, music, books, movies.
It was lovely. Yes, and I hear that. And possibly she's more extroverted and she gets like a lot of the energy from her friends and everything. I'd be a little worried that the plans are not encouraging, are not including him at all.
Yeah.
And that's and I'm hearing a bit of fear from him. He's like, it doesn't feel safe anymore, you know.
Yeah, because you say it's probably an experience that a lot of people have experienced.
Oh, it is.
And what's your advice then, just generally? Because as you say, people were forced into certain situations during lockdown. Now we're coming out the other side. Hmm. Things have changed. How do you address that?
Like Ray said, straight out and
straight
say,
out.
I miss you. I understand that you want to see your friends and it's so important. How do you see this going forward? You know, like, so you're beginning to kind of create a shared reality where the plans, you know, do they involve him or not?
And I think one of the things around attachment, either attachment is super glue, in which case it will break, or it's an elastic band, so it can stretch and the other person will bounce back.
What an analogy. So you don't want the super glue option.
No, definitely not the super glue option.
Yeah. So it's an adjustment. It's a readjustment. And they need to get to know each other in this this environment as opposed to
the bigger world and the wider world.
Isn't it the same thing in all of them? It's about people kind of walking towards hard conversations and just like, let's not be scared anymore and just have them. And then you know where you stand.
Okay, well, we've about a minute now. So you've brought up something which is really important, having the conversation. Are there any tips on having those conversations? Like, I remember somebody saying, and I've used it a couple of times, write it down.
Yes.
Right? So that then when you're having the conversation, you don't have to make eye contact, which is probably against all the rules. But you're saying there's a couple of things I want to say to you, and you just read off the points. And the other thing is that you don't miss anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes in the heat of a conversation, you forget to say things and then you're kicking yourself afterwards. So what advice would you give?
I like the writing it down beforehand, but I definitely wouldn't be sitting there with my notes.
Right, okay.
I would have it clear, identified in your mind as what do I actually want to express? You know, what needs are not being met and how will I express this to the significant person? And then the conversation begins.
And likewise, I think trying to have the conversation is more important than succeeding in every aspect of the conversation. Conversation leads to further conversation.
Yeah, start the ball rolling. And
that's
all
it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ray O'Neill, thank you very much. Alison Keating, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you again soon. That's it from us. Cormac and Sarah are on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday evening. Yes.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.